That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. Well, that's what she said.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said. Everyone keeps writing and saying, every time you say your intro, you're like, this is going to be short because I want to get to the interview. But I really mean it this time because I really want to get to the interview. And I kept Mike Silver of the NFL Network longer than I anticipated because I just find him fascinating and interesting and I love his stories. So I am going to skip the intro and I'm going to get straight to my interview with Mike Silver. Here it is.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
Joined this week by sports writer and TV analyst for the NFL Network and NFL.com. You can always find him on The Aftermath every Monday, noon to 2 Pacific time. On NFL Network, you can also find him roasting trolls on Twitter, on The Daily, formerly of Sports Illustrated and Yahoo Sports, also an author. He's done freelance work for places like Rolling Stone and GQ. I've known you for, feels like many years now, Michael Silver. We've never worked together. We just end up in the same place a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we will at some point. But remember, we are working together to make our world a less insane place every
that
minute of every day.
That is true.
So I do consider us, partners in that endeavor. But I remember, Sarah, I think it was a Super Bowl in Tampa way back when, where you were a young go-getter. And I always noticed the people with drive and intensity and guts. So, that's how I first remember seeing you.
I'm trying to remember what year that was. That was probably...
We'd have to go back to the Google machine. I'm pretty good at this. It might have been Ravens. Might have been Ravens, Giants. So
I'm looking it up now. I'm trying to. Now was this? This was not the Super Bowl where we were hanging out with Richard, not Richie, incognito. This was a few before that.
Yeah, Richard. We were really blessed that year to have Richard and not Richie because, you know, heaven knows for much of my career I would have been more prone to rolling with Richie,
right?
Just for the action. You know, it's funny. I just did a feature on Leonard Fournette that ran on Game Day Morning.
Yeah, you cursed him.
On Sunday, yeah, and apparently there is a bit of a curse going on with our features anyway. You know, and listen, I worked at SI for 13 and a half years. I'm well familiar with the curse argument, and I used to say, well, Michael Jordan's been on the cover more than anyone, so
right,
to curse
right.
him. But apparently we're really having a rough year. So the story runs, and a little more than an hour later, it is announced by the Jaguars that he's been deactivated for violation of team rules. And so first of all, many people reacted like I had broken the rule, which, you know, sadly it was just a coincidence. But I did get a text from former colleague Warren Sapp that basically said, you show up to town and he breaks a rule. And my answer was, that would have been a lot more plausible in the 90s or early 2000s that I would have actually been involved, as Warren knows well. But Richard, you know, it's interesting with Richie Incognito because, that's someone that on paper, you know, might not align with many of my views, certainly not in terms of, you know, the current political
landscape. How you treat other people, yeah.
Yeah, and yet, I have gotten to know him, and I think, we are aligned in some other ways, and for some reason, Sarah, the crazies and I...
I remember. You didn't mind him much, and I was so confused. We were at some pool party. This was probably Miami now, so 2010. No. It was more recently than that, maybe.
No, it was Phoenix. I think it was Phoenix. Phoenix.
Yeah, Glendale. Glendale.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Glendale,
yeah. We were
right
by some sort of pool, and you were like, oh, yeah, this is my buddy, Richard. And I was like,
Richard.
I was like, there are other versions of the name Richie that might be more appropriate. I think I even said to him, I would have gone with Dick.
He would admit to that. I mean, the good thing about him is he not only admits that he is prone to doing some ridiculous things, but he also admits that he's nuts. And, I don't say that cavalierly, but my wife's a clinical psychologist, and I know that Richie has, had treatment for various, issues and has been pretty open about it. So I like him better when he's Richard, it's amazing. I literally, so the New York Super Bowl, which was Seahawks Broncos. So I'm, really bad with my Romans. I think it was, XXX.
I wait,
X,
no.
XL,
XLV?
Yeah, maybe it was
I,
like, I mean, it's getting just ridiculous. But, you know, that day, the Saturday before the Super Bowl, I got two phone calls, like I'd say from about 5 p.m. to 11 p.m. And I was really trying to shut it down. I kind of been a little snacky. I was, you know, basically just trying to lay low. And I got two calls. One was from Dennis Rodman, who I go way, way back with.
Yeah, you wrote a book with him, right?
Yeah, and it was the most coherent and awesome I'd heard him in a long, long time. He was, you know, we talked about a lot of interesting things, including North Korea, and he was super lucid and, you know, he just, you know, I think he'd just been in some sort of program where he was sober at the time, and it was just a really, really, you know, pleasant surprise and a cool conversation. And then I got a frantic phone call a few hours later from Richie, that certainly was not Richard, who was, you know, like at the other end of the spectrum. I don't know about sobriety, but was just sounding nutty. And, you know, we talked about it later because don't think it was his finest hour. But,
right.
You know, the juxtaposition of those.
What was he calling you for? Meet him out? What was Richie calling you for?
I think Dennis was just catching up, and Richie wanted me to go on our Super Bowl pregame show and tell the real story about whatever he was ranting about. I had to kind of calmly explain to him, like, dude, we are not talking about you on our Super Bowl pregame show.
Yeah, you're a far nicer man than I am with some things, because I remember even in the moments with Richard, I was like, not this guy.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's funny because, I mean, I'm certainly like, you know, I do that too. And, you know, especially I feel like it's a lot easier for me at this stage of our country's history and at this stage of my life to draw a line in the sand. And, you know, sometimes for business reasons, you know, I might, you know, interact with people that I don't love. But, you know, when you start getting into, you know, racial injustice and social injustice and, you know, the both sides-ing of Nazism and white supremacy and things that are just so clearly unconscionable and intolerable, I get to the point where I'm like, well, if you are, I'm not even going to say supporting that. If you're cool with that, then it's pretty easy for me to say we don't need to have a relationship.
Right, right. So let's go backwards from, you know, not just talking about when we hung out. By the way, that Tampa Super Bowl was 2009. So, yeah, that was, I believe, the one where I slept on the floor at my friend's apartment that she'd already moved out of. And bought a shower curtain and stole internet from the neighbors.
You were squatting.
Yeah, I packed a sleeping bag and a pillow in my suitcase so I could sleep on her completely empty.
So wait, 2009, so that was the Cardinals Steelers.
Yeah. Oh, wait, yeah, and I was working for a startup website here, and my friend from that was working on Two Live Stews radio show wrote me down on the security credentials as a guest on their show every day to get me into the media radio row so that I could set up my own table and do my own interviews, because otherwise
well,
I didn't get credentials.
You found me on the street.
Yes,
I remember seeing you
did.
On the street.
Yes, night. That's right. Well, I want to go back to, so you grew up wanting to always do this. Was this what you wanted to do?
Well, so I grew up in L.A. where there was a really, really good sports page, the LA Times, and, you know, kind of emulating my father, I would take it into the bathroom for a long period every morning and just, you know, read all the really good journalists. But, you know, really, if I had to say, it's, you know, it's Watergate, Pentagon Papers, All the President's Men, all the, you know, I grew up at a time, I was pretty young, but I grew up at a time where journalism was, in my opinion, a really noble profession, you know, a lot of fearless, cool people who, you know, were not willing to settle for not finding out the truth, helped change history in a positive way. So that, you know, it really started there. Because the LA Times sports page was so good, I think I was, you know, and I do love sports, I was kind of gravitating that way. And then honestly, like working on my junior high school papers, you know, it was either Principal Mercer today announced that, you know, the fall semester would be shortened. Or you could be talking about your buddy's, you know, 62-inch vertical leap. And, right. you know, you had a lot more leeway on the sports page. And then finally, in high school, I found a co-author for a sports column who was twisted and funny and took it with about the same degree of gravity that I did. And that guy used to make fun of me for being a Warrior fan because I had been born in San Francisco and rooted for all the Bay Area teams, usually, you know, incurring misery. So now that that guy actually coaches that team, I have been shamelessly enjoying it.
So you guys were friends growing up, you and Steve Kerr.
Yeah, I mean,
that's really cool.
Yeah, just, you know, and really honestly, like, phenomenal person then and better now.
And with my Bulls, you know, of course.
Yep, yep. And listen, I could talk for a long time about this, but I'm just so proud of him, you know, the husband and father and man that he is, you know, incredible. And everything else that comes with that, including the crazy success on the basketball court and as a coach and as a broadcaster, I'm super, super proud. And I have been reminding him for many, many years that he is the only person ever to be dunked on by Michael Silver and Michael Jordan. Unfortunately, mine was in pool basketball.
I was going to say, was this a Nerf situation?
It was Nerf.
You're pretty
Nerf
tall, but I don't respect the hops.
I'll never forget. We brought Steve over. I got a pool when I was like late junior year of high school. We had a pool put in L.A. and Steve came over finally and joined us, and we only had one rule, and it was seldom enforced, and the rule was no drowning. But basically, everything else was going on, and he's a very white guy, and he went home pink, and you know, yes. It was poor guy, but great. Great, great, great person.
Not from the sun, from your ferocious dunking ability. You would just
He was just scratched up. Treated very rudely. Just so, left a lot of blood in that pool.
What did your parents do?
They're both labor lawyers, employee side. They mostly represent police and firefighter unions across California. My dad was kind of a pioneer in the 70s in terms of lawyers actually starting to handle the contract negotiations, and they do a lot of disciplinary defense too. So my dad is still working in his mid 70s, is a complete animal, and also very highly regarded in certain NFL circles, because for a long time I was bringing him every summer on training camp trips. And so it's rare that I go a month without going to a stadium and having a Jerry Jones or an Andy Reid or, a Jerome Bettis or somebody being like, hey, how's your dad? Tell him
that's great.
It is really interesting. So back when I worked for Yahoo in 2011 and the lockout was going down and you know, that whole CBA negotiation, I was pretty not only opinionated, but, you know, I have a pretty strong sense of, employees' advocacy and how, you know, labor negotiations, can be, you know, seen from their perspective. And I was just kind of blown away by the amount of people out there on social media who probably in real life are, you know, screw the man, my boss.
Yeah. Until it's sports.
But somehow,
right.
You know, we're you know, pro-management knee-jerk. And, it is funny. I mean, I wrote a column equating the NFL to communist Russia or Soviet communism and, you know, drawing some parallels. I definitely, spoke my mind very strongly, sticking up for the players, and I also was the guy who did owner rankings both at SI and
right.
Yahoo.
We're gonna get into the content that you used to do that you can't or aren't currently doing in a little bit.
Kind of a miracle.
You're now working for the man, which is crazy. I am the child of two lawyers as well. So I think that that's where you know, some of our similarities come into play too, our willingness to debate and argue and get into things and have very strong principled takes on things that matter. You ended up at Berkeley too, which I'm sure didn't hurt in terms of flexing your advocacy muscles.
Correct.
So tell me about your time there.
It was pretty much the greatest, you know, stretch I could imagine. I met my future wife. Our oldest kid goes there now. I'm a blatant Cal propagandist. And it was the mid-80s, so music was kind of, in my opinion, real down. It kind of got rolling again in the early 90s. But the Grateful Dead did play a lot of shows in the Bay Area, so we got to go to a lot of those. I think Cal, I mean, one of the first things I was told when I got to Cal, you know, our rival is Stanford, and, you know, I think we all respect each other academically, unlike in some rivalries, but, you know, most Stanford students are not really like us, and the way it was put to me very early on was that at Stanford, they teach you to wash your hands after you urinate, and at Cal, they tell you not to piss on your hands, and there's a real kind of utilitarian intellectual intensity, but also a creativity and a defiance where you're not only taught that there are different ways to look at things, but you're kind of taught that you should look for alternative solutions and, innovative, weird, unconventional ways of solving problems. And that challenging authority is one of the culture's bedrock values with the free speech movement and so many other elements of Cal's legacy or UC Berkeley's legacy. So, we always used to believe that, it's not easy going there. They don't make it easy. You had to fight literally for these class cards back then that, you know, the hard copy that would, you know, allow you to take a class. There's nowhere to park. Housing was a free for all. You know, it's just, they do not hold your hand. They flunk you out if you slip. And, it was not a super easy experience, but, you know, that hardened us and it bonded us. And we always used to say, well, when we get out of the real world, we're going to be, you know, ready to go take it and not expect people to, you know, hold our hands and not be entitled. And I've really largely seen that play out. A lot of people I know, a lot of my peers have gone on to, you know, not only do really cool things, but things that kind of fit into that pattern. And, so that to me would be when I sell Cal, and I do it often, and there are a lot of great things about it, but, you know, that's kind of the distinguishing characteristic. You know, the play, which is the five lateral kickoff return through the Stanford band in the 1982 big game, that had happened right before I started as a freshman, but by weird twist of fate, I was there as a high school senior. And I'm not sure that happens somewhere else, and it had never been conjured before that could happen, and it changed football forever, because now why would you not try to just pitch it or, you know, try the desperation pitch? And I really kind of connected with that, and I'll just say one more thing. You know, when we talk about why I think Cal helped me, and back in 2004, so our holy grail is the Rose Bowl. It's, you know, Cubs light. We have not been in my lifetime, not since 1959. And we, that's what we care about most, and just going to the Rose Bowl. And weird circumstances at times have conspired to keep us out. Usually it's because we're not very good. But in 2004, we had
Aaron Rodgers. It's a heck of a conspiracy theory.
We had Aaron Rodgers and Marshawn Lynch, right. And we had a great team that almost beat SC, was number one. And, you know, the system keeps changing on us. But that year, SC played in the national championship game. Back then, there was only a two-team championship that they put into a bowl. The Rose Bowl wanted us. We wanted them. We were 10-1. We were number three in the country. And yet, I won't even bore you, but about five rules that no longer exist all – conspire to keep us out, including like some flat out voting, you know, suck up pandering by then Texas coach Mack Brown and you know, just a weird kind of late screw over. So it meant more to us, not having that than it would have to Texas. They would have been understandably bummed out, but for us, it was cataclysmic. And I kind of saw all this coming in late October, early November, because I am, a fatalist and when it mm-hmm. comes to Cal sports. And I was, I was using my bully pulpit at SI.com mostly, where I was kind of writing columns on the side to draw attention to this and why I thought, Cal should get more votes. And I would get letters or emails at the time, I guess, mostly from irate people, and some of them would say, how can Sports Illustrated allow Michael Silver to, blatantly, in his biased ways, blah, blah, blah. And my response, I used to do email reply columns because they were fun. It was before Twitter. So I basically, my reply was always like, well, maybe if someone at your lame school had gone on to prominence and to acquire this bully pulpit and then also simultaneously would be shameless enough to use it in this, completely one-sided way, then you would have a counterpoint. So I make no apologies. Go Bears. Someday we'll go to the Rose Bowl. I was so happy when the Cubs finally won because it proves that anything is possible.
Anything, literally. Hell has frozen over.
Right. And my writing partner, the guy who I was co-sports editor with at the Daily Cal, went to New Trier and was a great Chicago kid. So this poor kid had the double whammy. He was a Cubs and Cal fan for life. Ooh. I mean, I can't imagine anything, more brutal.
Right, one down, one to go, I guess.
That's right.
Yeah, there you go. So you leave Cal, you work for the Santa Rosa Press Democrat, covering the Niners and the Warriors, then covering the Niners for the Sacramento Union, then you work for Pro Football Weekly, the Sporting News. You end up at SI in 94. Is that the right timeline?
Vaguely? Well, here's what really happened. I got a job covering the 49ers for the Sacramento Union when I was very young, and I was, making $20,000 a year and stoked to be doing it and grinding. And after, in that first season, which was 1989, which was the year they repeated as Super Bowl champs and won their fourth of the decade, they made us all, the paper was sold, they made us reapply for our jobs, and one morning I was essentially laid off along with one of my best friends from college, Mike Fleiss, who I had followed to the Union, and we kind of sat around for a few months, making it work, stringing for the AP, working on a screenplay, which was not awesome. And although it was funny, I remember at one point we were trying to write comedy, and Mike said, maybe we, instead of writing this lame script, we should be writing a script about two guys trying to write comedy, but their life is so miserable that they just can't be funny. And that was actually right. So Mike ended up, we both tried to get on with the Press Democrat, which is another kind of small paper in the area. I did. I beat him out. He went to Hollywood, grinded his way, and went on to create The Bachelor, among other ridiculously successful ventures.
I knew I recognized the name.
Yeah. And he, another Cal person fighting their way through the abyss. But, so then I got on at Santa Rosa, and that was really cool. But, by the time I was 29, I'd been there a few years. I was now a columnist, and I was kind of frustrated because I thought I was pretty good, and I had applied for some bigger paper jobs, many of them in Northern California, and hadn't gotten them. And, I was just the work atmosphere was feeling a little toxic because I was accused of self-promoting. I mean, I guess I was. I was just trying really, really hard to be good and get noticed, and it was pre-internet. But
which now is a job requirement.
Exactly.
Can work at places like that is to promote so hard that you get the clicks and hits needed to keep it sustained.
I mean, I was having my clips from the Santa Rosa Press Democrat faxed down to 49er headquarters so they would be put in the clips packet. And people, it's funny because I was close with Joe Montana, but also tight with Steve Young when they were going through I laugh at some of these things, now where people go, oh my God, there's a feud between those. I'm like, you have no idea what it was like covering two future Hall of Famers, with one trying to push the other out. But I managed to stay tight with both of them all these years. And you know, people said, how? Because I was a columnist. And they, I said, well, they only saw what I wanted them to see because my stuff was in Santa Rosa. So I'd write a nice story about Joe and give him the newspaper, or I'd do something for Steve. But, you know, they never knew when I was brutal. So, yeah, I mean, I was kind of at a crossroads, not sure what I wanted to do and thinking about some other things. And then I kind of got the miracle SI call from an editor I had worked with as an intern at Newsday coming out of college, who was on at SI and just at least gave me the chance for me to send some articles in and get a look. And then it was just a whirlwind. And, you know, next thing I knew, I was hired. My first story, which was not necessarily intended as a big story, ended up on the cover. And within less than a year, I was, you know, following Dennis Rodman around on a four-state bender that became an infamous cover story where he had the bird on the shoulder and the metallic hot pants. And, the, and it just, you know, it went really, really well. So, you know, and SI was pretty much my dream job as a sports writer, and I thought I would never leave. I had an amazing 13 and a half years, and I kind of, you know, surprised myself when I even thought about leaving, but, you know, still on great terms with my former employer, and love those guys.
And what brought you to Yahoo? Was it just that they had the money to try to pull you away?
Well, the money was really good, although I think I would have been okay staying. It was a weird thing. This a really really smart and inspired guy, Dave Morgan, was running it, and he kind of, you know, built Yahoo as we knew it. And I had, you know, been talking to him for a while, and I was really excited about possibly working for him. But when he finally made me the offer, it was essentially, come here, we'll pay you a bunch, and we'll figure out what the job should be. You decide, just make it cool. And I was like, I don't know if I ever get that offer again. You know, that's a once in a lifetime. And, you know, at SI, it was always magazine first, and I say that without judgment. You know, it's an amazing magazine, but the internet stuff at SI was always going to be, you know, your B material by definition. And I just thought in 2007, I felt like it was harder to not have your killer stuff be what was online, just noticing the way I was changing my consumption habits and the way the world was going. And it's funny, like a lot of people didn't get it when I left in 07, but I think like 6 months later, people were, you know, a lot of people were like, oh, okay, you know, I get that. And then, you know, I kind of felt similarly in 2013 when I went to NFL Network in terms of TV. I never thought of myself as a TV person. I did video stuff, I did TV stuff, but it just always seemed like a side endeavor. And I'm very comfortable that I'm a writer. That's what I do. I'm a reporter, I'm a journalist, and, you know, an opinionated one, but, you know, that was my thing. And by 2013, I was just kind of thinking, it's hard not to have a TV presence right now, just the way things are going for me. And also, honestly, I've just written so much, it seemed like a kick in the butt and a new challenge. And, you know, where I ended up was kind of surprising to me and everyone else, but it kind of made sense.
Yeah, I mean, you clearly have the bona fides to be an NFL-focused guy and the relationships, but to come from your entire background being super opinionated, a guy who pushes the envelope, who likes to cross the lines, who does stories on the biggest, most outrageous people like Rodman, to end up where you are working for a league, and I presume somewhat limited by the fact that you are working under and for the NFL. What was that transition like? And was there a lot of growing pains, or were you clear pretty early on that this was going to be very different?
Well, it's interesting. We, you know, before NFL Network launched, Eric Weinberger, who was the one who ended up hiring me there, they had a building but had not launched. And I actually went in and talked to them then. That must have been 2003. And, we look back at the conversation and we were almost laughing, like, there's no way it was ever going to happen. It just seemed ridiculous. And honestly, like, growing up, when I grew up, the thought that I would work for a league or, you know, I mean, it just seems, it's everything we were taught in journalism that you would never do, right? So, It made no sense then. We talked for, I was doing a bunch of stuff for them, and we kind of talked maybe in the year leading up to when I ended up going. But at one point, you know, I feel like when I watched their coverage during the lockout, I was ready to roll my eyes and think, you know, this is state-run television. This is ridiculous. And I was really impressed that they, you know, looked more like a news organization than anything else. I thought, you know, certainly the people who own this network are clearly invested on one side of this issue, but they weren't just throwing propaganda out on their network. So that kind of caught my attention. And I remember saying to Eric, you know, if I ever came here, you would need to let me go, because the viewer has to believe it's real, and they would be watching me extra closely, I would think. So we don't, you know, from a business perspective, you don't want it to look like Pravda, and I would never want to work at Pravda. For you young people, that's Soviet state-run media.
Yes, and propaganda versus...
Honestly, it just... You know, we kind of had an understanding. I mean, I would just say this. I mean, the only way that I self-modified was, you know, maybe the ways that I used to kind of torture owners on a kind of a personal level, in a way that, you know, which was, I was pretty fringe that way. But like, I would kind of clown them, and these are people who are not used to being clowned. So I kind of self-regulated that, and maybe that's a sign of maturity. But, you know, there's a way to get your same message across. In other words, if somebody asked me right now, what do I think about the name Redskins? I would say, well, Daniel Snyder is one of my bosses. He obviously wants to keep it. I completely disagree with him. I think it's a racist nickname, and I think it offends people, and it's preposterous that that is the name. So does that mean I'm getting fired by Daniel Snyder and 31 other owners? Hopefully not, because I'm on the right side of history.
And not the first time he's heard it, of course.
Yeah, well, and what do you expect? So, I mean, I think
it's about not personal shots. You can have opinions, but they have to be delivered professionally, which is something I think a lot of us just do more when we get older anyway, right? It feels
right
to handle things that way versus taking shots.
Yeah, the hardest, you know, I mean, I feel like we haven't had that moment yet, and I've been there, you know, 4+ years. We have not had that moment yet where I said, I've got a story to report. I want to report this. And they have said, we can't report that on our network because the people who own it will freak out. Now, if that happens, it's going to be, I don't know what will happen if that happens.
Now, have you not had those stories cross your path, or have you had stories of interest that they said, you know, this needs to be reported, so we're okay with you doing it?
I mean, I've just kind of done what I do, and we haven't ever had a moment like that yet. Now, you know, and I think there's also a misconception where fans think like, oh, Roger Goodell is your boss. Like, I honestly don't think of Roger Goodell as my boss. I think of Robert Kraft as
editors
and my boss. But like, you know, I mean, I've said to Roger even, like, you know, we've joked about it. I've said, like, I've been crushing you on our network, and, you know, he's kind of taking it well. He knows it's good for business. He knows he's in a position that is supposed to take the heat for, you know, all of our bosses. And trust me, if I got Roger Goodell's, you know, compensation package, I'd take those bullets too. So, the hardest time for me was when, and it's funny because Bob Mueller ended up being involved, but, you know, the Ray Rice, you know, fiasco and then accompanying investigation was a weird time to be on the air at NFL Network. And I was on the air a lot. And it was, there was this sense of kind of like, whoa, not the league clearly handled it poorly, but kind of like, I think there was an initial hysteria, like, wow, it might all be collapsing for us. This is a bad, bad moment for the NFL. So it was tricky for me on live television, and someone who, you know, hadn't been on live television a ton until the year before, it was tricky for me to kind of, you know, try to be me at first. Now, I think, after a couple of days, I hit my stride and I was able to say, you know, this is an embarrassment for our league. Like, because it was. My bosses and my employers and the league office were doing a horrible job of navigating a brutal situation. So, the other thing that was weird was that I was getting a lot of, not just then, is that I've gotten a lot of, you know, you work for the man, you sold out, admonishments from retired players, people who kind of, I guess, had come to look to me to keep the league in check at times.
Yeah.
And so I feel like I've been judged kind of strongly that way. But, honestly, it hasn't been as horrible as I feared it could be, but you know, I reserve the right to
change that. Next time we talk, right?
Yeah, and Sarah, you know me, you'll know.
Yeah, like, yes, we'll hear about it for sure. I wonder. You know, you mentioned Ray Rice, and he's someone that was surprising to me because, you know, I don't get into players outside of Chicago in a really super meaningful way beyond covering them. But I remember I had seen him on Ellen talking about anti-bullying, and I just really felt an affinity for him and how he handled his business. I started following him on Facebook and thinking that he was really representative of a guy who got it. So I was just shocked when I saw that. I wonder if you, in your time in the NFL, you've obviously made tons of friendships and relationships, if there are people – players or former players or whatever that you've had their back, you've been supportive, and things have changed and you've said, oh, I really just didn't get that. Whether, I don't know if you were there when Sharper was there. I mean, on a much smaller level, I feel that way about Cam Newton right now. I was very defensive of him even when he was walking out of Super Bowl conferences. I thought he's got a fun swagger, he's got an attitude, and he takes losses hard, and I like that. And now I think he's immature, he can't handle himself, and he's not professional. His comment, of course, bothered me, but beyond that, the way he's handled it has. Are there people like that that you've sort of kind of over the years been like, oops, I might have been defending the wrong person?
That's a really good question. I mean, first of all, as far as the Cam Newton thing, my first reaction when I saw, you know, the infamous press conference footage was, oh no, my lack of route tree knowledge is about to be exposed in a big way. I've covered the league for a long time, and I've picked up a lot of valuable, you know, strategic pointers, but I'm not trying to act like someone who, you know, knows the routes the way football players do. So, you know, the poor, you know, I know women are going to get brutally judged by that standard, but I just kept laughing going, well, they only knew how little I knew.
And, yeah, and, you know, like, I hope they don't quiz us today.
Yeah, and honestly, like, I've always thought that was a strength for me, that the way I presented myself to football people, I was very clearly saying, hey, you guys study this stuff. Can you draw that for me? Can you explain it to me so I can try to explain it to people in a way that they'll understand? And that's been very well received, you know, much more. I've seen people who kind of act like they know what players know, and by and large, they don't. And I've seen the eye rolls too. So, I mean, Darren Sharper's a great question because I covered him as a rookie and knew him very, very well. And he was then a colleague at NFL Network, and all of a sudden, like, you know, whoa. So, I mean, I guess I don't really look back and say I shouldn't have had people back. I kind of call it like I see it. And when I know you, you know, and we talked about Richie earlier, when it's someone I know, I feel like I can at least, you know, defensively defend my friends. But, I guess it's just, I feel like I'm old enough and have been, you know, rough around the edges enough that I've screwed up before. And I'm a big believer in, you know, really apologizing in the right way. And I think you have to, you know, when you're wrong, you have to eat it. You have to be very clear about eating it. You have to say, I'm going to try really, really hard to be better at this. And I don't think you qualify it. I don't think, you know, even when you have a good explanation or but this happened, or if I offended someone, I think you just say, I really screwed that up, and I'm going to try really, really hard to do better. And so I guess if it's someone I know and they mess up on certain things and they do that, I kind of go, okay, well, because I think as humans, we kind of understand that. You know, obviously there are some things that, you know, are so horrible that, you know, what are you going to do? You just throw up your hands. So, Dennis Rodman, who I'm very close with and who has stuck up for me in some situations where I'm forever grateful. You know, when I was a young SI writer and he went on David Letterman right after that crazy story hit, and where he talked about gay sex fantasies and Madonna right. and all sorts of other things. And Letterman twice tried to basically give him a forum to deny it. And he sat there saying, oh, it's a great story. I love this story. And, you know, that I'm really touched by that. Time where, you know, that would have been brutal for me. He told the truth and stood by me, and I have great affection for him. But I mean, you know, when the dude's hanging out with a brutal dictator who's,
that's a problem. Or atrocity. Darren Sharp or whatever. There are things you can't look beyond the same way. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's always a conversation. If you know him, there's always a conversation. If you don't know him, I think you just you weigh in the best you can, but even if it's someone I don't
and you
know,
learn that you don't know people as well as you think, and that you take when people ask me about athletes, oh, is this guy nice? Is this guy nice? I'll say, yeah, he seems nice, or he's nice in professional athlete adjusted terms, which means that probably cheats on his wife, all those things, but is nice to me in the moments that I have to interact.
Well, and I believe in, I believe in improvement and apology. So, you know, Camden's apology I thought was about the right way to apologize. It just, obviously it would have been better if he didn't force the issue in the first place. But, everything's a work in progress.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned your relationships with a lot of people, and you seem to manage to pick up other successful people along the way, whether that's being friends with Steve Kerr or Mike Fleiss or Aaron Rodgers, or you're friends with Adam Duritz. What do you think it is about you that is so either disarming or charming or interesting that allows either you to attract other successful people or to have people who could very easily not want to be surrounded by a reporter or friends with a reporter want to have you around?
Great question, and I am, of course, incredibly charming. So, I grew up in L.A., so maybe I was a little less wowed by the star factor than some. I also grew up kind of, with a sense of self that's strong or self-important, so maybe I approach people thinking that, I'm just as important as they are, and that's freaking them out. But, honestly, as far as journalistically, I think... One things I've tried to do are, one, I try to play the long game every time, and there have been a lot of things I've known or could have reported that chose not to, that would have been great at the time, but might have not only sacrificed that relationship but gotten other people in our world to not trust me and believe that I'm someone who could burn you. I tend to throw myself out there pretty blatantly and quickly, almost as a show of, well, I'm putting it on the line too. I'm saying or doing something that, I wouldn't want you just throwing out there out of context. So now we're the same.
Yeah.
And then, hopefully it's just, I think, most of what I've done has been work ethic and hopefully people skills. And, I haven't always had the best people skills. Sometimes I don't. But, I think growing up in L.A., we had a court-ordered desegregation system in place where our schools, our public schools, had to be integrated to a certain degree. So there was busing, and we kind of had the best of both worlds at my junior high and high school in that we had a lot of people voluntarily coming in. And we didn't have to go out. So I say, I am pro busing, which is kind of extreme, but I also had the best possible experience, in terms of not being inconvenienced. But I mean, honestly, I've felt like being in racially integrated, context from a young age, you just kind of, a lot of the stereotypes and the BS, and this from being in the sports world, you just know that it's garbage instinctually from a very, very young age, because you just see so many different types of people in different contexts, and that it's nuanced. So I just had more of a comfort or have had more of a comfort in those contexts than other people, certainly in my era. And, I've never really thought about that consciously, but I hope that plays into the people skills thing.
Yeah, easier to get along with people of all kinds, except for on Twitter, where you're really into clapbacks, which I am too.
Well, and I just, I mean, I know you and I have similar philosophies in some ways. And I mean, listen, I mean, first of all, and I know this applies to you too. First of all, it's my real estate. It's my Twitter.
Yeah.
So
right.
When the point is to tell me what I should be saying or what you think I should have said, or you didn't address this thing then.
Yeah.
Like, it's my feed. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, honestly, I get, one of my catchphrases has been Twitter isn't real. And I've been saying that for a long time. And I hope it doesn't become real. Like, I hope when I'm in a bar, I don't get the same kind of interactions in real life that I would get on there. But, I don't consider my Twitter persona or what's happening on my Twitter feed much of the time to be representative of how I really am dealing with real life. So it's very easy for me to be over the top or to, kind of laugh. And honestly, a lot of times I'm just looking to entertain myself and maybe a few people will get it. I mean, some people are like, when I'm having fun, I'm probably not on Twitter. Like, usually I'm in a line at the airport, or I'm like procrastinating a deadline where I used to shoot Nerf hoops, and now I'm, over tweeting. And, sometimes I do it in a very directed way, and obviously it's great for self promotion and all that. But when people fall into the trap of thinking that I'm taking it more seriously than I am, then that usually doesn't work either.
When does it get to you, though? Like, what gets to me is not so much like a death threats. It's when I feel like I'm misunderstood or misrepresented. And I don't know if part of that is the lawyer background of feeling like, wait, no, I'm debating this well and I'm saying what I want and you are still not understanding. So it's either a combination of ignorance or willful ignorance or misdirection. And those are the ones that, like, I find myself getting caught trying to convince someone of something. And then I'm like, listen, if I was at a party and someone just didn't get it, I would just walk away and talk to someone else.
Right.
I can't do that. And I have to remind myself of that. Like, this person's either a complete idiot or they're intentionally not willing to understand what we're talking about. And either way, I would just be done with them in real life. Yeah.
I mean, I totally get that. I mean, I would say this. First of all, it usually doesn't get to me, but if I'm having like a really bad day or, like something, I'm just down a little bit. And then sometimes I'll just get so depressed, just privately, just being like, wow, it's
the world
so dark.
Sucks.
And, but for the most part, what gets to me, and this, I'll block for blatant, anything, any bigotry or things like that, or blatant, just over the line, things like that, I'm going to block. But the thing that is the automatic block that has been from the start that I'm super firm on is the questioning of the journalistic integrity. And, I mean, it just astounds me. It's one thing when people think they know as much as you or more than you because they watch TV and read internet sites and, but they follow the team. And that, that's super offensive in the same way that if you and I were telling a dentist how to do her or his job, in terms of like bicuspids and stuff, it would be preposterous. But, when they start saying, oh, I'll bet you made that up or maybe I should be more evolved and, walk away from that. But it's just unacceptable to me. It goes back to what we talked about earlier, the reverence I have for the profession and all the great people who have, fearlessly put themselves on the line. And I just think you're questioning, the essence of my journalism. Like, I have no desire to have that conversation. So I thank heaven for the block button.
For sure. All right, I have a speed round for you. These are sports talk radio speed round. These are very standard sports radio questions that I never ask my pod, but since I have my NFL expert, I need to ask them. Most disappointing team this season?
Raiders?
Yeah, okay. Most surprising team this season?
Rams.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree with that. I was thinking to myself, I wonder if Chris Long is bummed that after all those years in St. Louis with a bad team, he didn't get to go to LA and be good. And then I was like, oh, wait, he's on the Eagles, and they're even better than the Rams. So he's doing okay.
He's on the Eagles, and he's blinded by his Super Bowl ring from last year.
Exactly, right, from the Patriots.
That's a good dude.
He's awesome. Coach of the year so far?
I would also say Sean McVay for the Rams. Just because, I mean, I'm super close with Jeff Fisher, like as close with him as anyone that I've been close with in football on the coaching side. You know, him and of course Hugh Jackson. I get he's my stepbrother from another mother, who by the way called during this podcast. So you must be important that I blew it off.
Yes, but, nice.
Yeah, I mean,
you missed the scoop. It's going to someone else.
Yeah, you know what? Probably. But, yeah.
You're
no
Schefter. You're supposed to just hang up on me.
Believe me. I've done worse. But, I love Jeff. I would defend Jeff. I would spend a lot of time defending him. He was not in charge of the offense, and, I think it was a regrettable situation in terms of that side of the ball there. But, you know, there's a large part of me that is, you know, super bummed that he didn't get it going there. On the other hand, I've known Sean for a while. I covered his grandpa as the GM of the Niners when I first started. He is a young hotshot, but he's not entitled. And, I'm really blown away by what he's been able to do there. And I've known Jared Goff since he was, you know, very young and, excited to see what those two have going there.
Your MVP so far?
That's a great
question. This one keeps changing.
So far, yeah, I mean, it was going to be Rodgers, and then he got hurt. I know everyone's all over the Carson Wentz thing. I have this feeling that it's going to be Russell Wilson when all is said and done.
Huh.
I have an immense faith in that team. I think they got better with Sheldon Richardson. The offense traditionally takes a while to get rolling. They made the trade for Dwayne Brown, which is going to help that offensive line. I have this feeling that when all is said and done, it will be the Seahawks and that he may be the guy that we're talking about.
Rookie of the year so far?
Deshaun Watson. My son was asking me this weekend, can Deshaun Watson still be rookie of the year with only 8 games played? I said, well, it might be the wrong 8, you know, if it was the last 8,
yeah.
Yes. But he might. I mean, you know, Kareem Hunt probably will be. But, I mean, seeing it in person, I went to his last game, you know, the Seahawks Texans game. And it just, in that stadium where Russell, you know, I remember seeing Russell for the first time as a rookie, and it just looked different in person. I was like, oh, wow. And similar with Deshaun. They're not really similar players, but it blew me away in that way. It was just kind of like, whoa, like this is different. So, he may end up being it. Even if he doesn't get the actual award, he's going to be the guy that we are talking about going into next season.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, and finally, the last thing that you have to do, everybody has to do it. Nobody expects it.
I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
It's the Spanish Inquisition. Number one, natural talent you'd like to be gifted with.
Like to be gifted with? I'd like to be good at another language like Spanish. I would like to be an incredibly gifted guitar player, because I think I'd be a good enough songwriter and wouldn't
would
have
nice.
To sing, but I could probably write killer rock songs if I could really rip.
That's like my sabbatical skill. If I just was given like 6 months of paid vacation and I had to learn something, it would be guitar. Number two, your desert island album. You can only have one.
I'd probably just dumb it down and take Sticky Fingers or Let It Bleed, one of the Great Stones, '70s classics. I just, you know, when I'm in a really, really bummed out mood, and I listen to my wheelhouse, Mick Taylor era Stones, really any Stones, but that, it just, you know, it calms me. It's kind of similar to like the Pacific Ocean. It just engulfs me and calms me down a little bit.
You know, your buddy Aaron Rodgers told me his is Counting Crows, August and Everything After, which is my Desert Island album, which reminds me that now publicly on the podcast, you have to confirm yet again that you are one day going to introduce me to Adam Duritz and get me on stage for Hanging Around when they close the show. So this has not yet happened, and this was several years ago that you made this promise.
We're working on it, Sarah. But August and Everything After, I laugh because, Adam didn't, he didn't graduate from Cal. He left a few units short of his degree. And what I believe he was a rhetoric major and he needed a thesis was his last thing. And I'm kind of like, well, he turned in his thesis. It's called August and Everything
After.
Yeah,
exactly.
Damn,
it's
degree.
A pretty damn good one.
Yeah.
That's funny. I didn't know he didn't graduate.
And it just makes me really mad because I'm not saying that I would be this anyway, but I wish that someone like someday could look back at the mid-80s and be like, you know, it's possible that the greatest writer of that era who went to Cal was Mike Silver, but because of Adam.
No, never. Sorry.
Makes me mad.
Well, I mean, I don't really hold out hope for being the greatest anything to come out of Cornell because.
Well, you actually, yeah. You know, you're young enough.
I got to do some big things, man. You got to do some big things.
You might be Governor Spain or something cool.
There you go. President, dream big.
Right. Are you 35? You're not 35, are you?
I am 35, yes, yeah.
All
I could be president.
Right now,
yeah.
I would cut
take
that
it?
Deal in a heartbeat if I could.
When I was a kid, I told my parents, I said, if there is not a female president by the time I grow up, I'm going to do it. And they were like, okay. And then I got older, and I was like, oh, no, there's like stuff that I wouldn't be interested in that you have to do if you're the president. And now yeah. I'm like, listen, I will
yeah.
take one for the team.
But you know what?
I will bite the bullet and do it.
Heart, so
yeah.
somebody might
yeah.
have to take one for the team.
It might need to happen, yeah. Number three, if you could switch lives with anyone for a day, who would it be?
Ooh, wow.
Yeah.
That is a great, great question. Bob Mueller.
Okay.
Just for one?
Yeah.
Just for a specific day.
Not long enough to screw everything up, but long enough to get some good info.
No, I would just want, there's one day coming that I would just enjoy.
Oh, okay, good. Number four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
A great question. Probably any time after I had kids that I got up on a wave boogie boarding in Hawaii that I used to take and then realized like that I am a complete wuss now that I'm a father. So any time in the ocean since then.
Yeah. Number five, what would you consider your biggest failure?
Wow. My biggest failure, you know, I think there is probably a side of me that is a little, you know, more creatively edgy and artist-like that I probably could have honed a little bit in some form, some writing form. And I feel like I kind of chose stability and functionality and, mm-hmm. you know, day-to-day happiness over the tortured artist vibe in some ways, and I'm really comfortable with that choice, and I get it, but it would have been interesting to see where that would have led.
Yeah, for sure. Number six, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
I think probably just, you know, kind of a relentlessness combined with not worrying about, you know, not worrying about potential ramifications. I want to say fearlessness, but that makes me sound too cool. But, you know, just journalistic boldness.
Yeah. Number seven, think about yourself you'd most like to improve.
Woo, that's a long one. I don't know if this is good for the speed route, but
yeah.
You know, patience would be nice.
Yeah.
Probably just you know, keeping things in perspective. I think I do a decent job, but, you know, it's we should all probably get a little better at that. And, you know, I just I don't know, man. We're living in a very strange time, so I try to, you know, give myself and others the benefit of the doubt. We're all every day kind of trying to process things and mm-hmm. figure it out and figure out how to navigate it. And, you know, I think we could all be better, but I also think we, you know, we should cut ourselves some slack as we figure it out.
Yeah, absolutely. And finally, last one, what three words would you most hope that people would use to describe you?
What three words would I use to describe me?
No, you hope other people would use to describe you.
Oh, let's see. I sincere.
Mm-hmm.
I committed. And I probably, I guess I'm trying to figure out what actual word it would be. Just.
Principled?
Yeah, well, I don't know about principled, but just someone on the right side.
Fair.
Of justice.
Fair.
Fair, yeah. Fair.
Okay. Just, we'll give you just and fair. We'll give you four. Yeah.
Honestly, I hope they would say I'm a good parent and, you know, family person and that I, you know, care about social justice and am not afraid to stick up for those who are getting the wrong end of the deal.
Well, I think you're doing all right so far. We'll see how it goes. We'll see how, you know.
Yeah,
only time will tell.
Another day.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Only time will tell.
I think you've ended up on an elevator because I've kept you so long, but I appreciate you hanging out with me.
Thanks for having me. Good times, and we'll have to be in the same city one of these weeks and continue this over beers.
There you go.
Oh, and another thing.
This week's That's What She Read is a piece in The New Yorker by Ronan Farrow that I found fascinating. It's a long read, but it's worth your time. It's called Harvey Weinstein's Army of Spies, about how the film executive hired private investigators to track down actresses and journalists and do undercover research about what information they had about Weinstein's harassment, assaults, and rapes, and what they were willing to tell. And it is an incredibly well-reported, well-documented piece that gets into the lengths that Weinstein was willing to go in order to send people using false identities to meet with actresses like Rose McGowan or women who had worked under Weinstein and find out whether they were talking to the press, what they were willing to say, and potentially try to shut it down. And, you know, people say so often about women who, especially women who come out later, whether that's in the Cosby allegations or, you know, Darren Sharper, who I talked to Mike Silver about, but why don't they come out first? Why do they wait so long? Why don't they say anything? You know, why does it take one or two saying something for 100 plus, which is now what it is in the case of Weinstein, to come forward? And it's not just fear of not being believed, fear of being criticized, shame, but also stuff like this in these high profile cases where they are literally great lengths and great millions and millions of dollars being spent trying to silence them. It's remarkable that any of them made it out to speak. And the more that come forward, the more you realize that this was such a tangled web. The amount of money that his company was willing to spend to control people from talking and to make things go away. And what is heartening about all of this, which has been so tough to watch, is that it's setting into motion more action and more serial predators being caught up in what they've done. And if it gets more women to talk, and if it gets more people, not just women, more victims to talk about people who are abusing their power, then at least that's the silver lining on what's a very dark cloud of uncovering the truth behind so many people in power positions. So again, it's in The New Yorker by Ronan Farrow, called Harvey Weinstein's Army of Spies. I recommend you take the time out to read it. Thanks as always for lasting about an hour with me.
That's what she said.